Blog Talk Radio.
Let's go. Yeah. Ghetto children singing. See, what up? They eager to learn how to become the next world leaders. Brave hearts. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Book one, strategy, tactics, techniques. Look dumb, but massively notice the weakness in all of them. Gotta you show me if necessary. Homie, vestige is very real if enemies carrying heavy steel. Beware the thugs who ain't scared of blood or jail time. When Aryan nations ain't having integration, we so blind to beauty of life. But when my mom said again, you could be Christ. I wasn't old enough to hold my d***ing P-right. Jesus, what is he like? I picture him standing with diamonds on him. Little different from the way my mommy saw him. Practice your aiming, physical training and difficult terraining. Test your endurance, try to keep your stamina banging, splitting duchess up, strap up. The armies of school, teaching smart ways to life. I'm thinking Gandhi was a fool, the chronic's a fool. Got me thinking out loud. Sleep on my drunkenness, I blow your brains out. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
My revolution is as real as Bobby Seals. I build with dudes and Chris worth a quarter mil and Dick Hill. For fish gills, the cops, the time come, I mask up and get my comrade off the bus. Up the beef, I snatch a seed from Chuck E. Cheese and feed them to the rats in the back of the peas. Black fatigue and off the scenes on a sofa. 50-inch flat screen, Louis Vuitton holsters. My motions don't appeal to appellate division. I did it strong for 7 long years in prison. Of the system, I'm like a modern-day Hitler. Black gorilla, crib and blood and one only. Just know my face, I be the case for the wish at the police. Look at the name Lake. Go simultaneously with street revolution. 21 gun salute the new Huey Newton.
Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Teach our woman how to hold a family down in case something happens to us fathers. Protect the children, grab revolvers. The woman plays an important part of our life force. Of what we fight for, my heart goes to you beautiful wife in war.
Enlist in war and talk less. Watch all and trust none. Demand your respect and be ready to die for what you believe in. And ride all the time, not just when convenient.
Justice and freedom, wisdom and understanding. We the lost children of Israel in this Western world region. You ain't a man, you a coward if you can't support the girl you put a seed in.
Strong rule the weak, but the wise rule is strong. It's more to a war than just getting it on. Seal your form, cover your tracks, stay prepared. I don't care, no one's spared.
Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mitch Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson,
sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see you today.
Dorden from TVCSI.
This is the military, David.
Free the land, revolutionary ingredient. Mother to know this is Jordan, Mr. Radio, and your host, Duman Shakir, where our goals are fivefold. Our first goal is to eradicate functional literacy among new African prisoners. Our second goal is to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal is to transform the criminal mentality to new African mentality. Our fourth goal is to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African communities. Our fifth goal is to prepare a new African prisoner for release, reducing new African recidivism. Now, overall goal is transforming the whole prison industrial slave complex to produce the big institutional learning through educational means. Before I bring in a guest tonight, I want to go over a couple of events that happened in history during this week. In 1862, Union forces assumed control of New Orleans, bringing the Union army into direct contact with thousands of slaves and free new Africans. 1863, Confederate Congress passed a resolution that branded new African troops and their officers criminals. Resolution in effect doomed captured new African soldiers to death for slavery. 1866, from the 1st to the 3rd, white terrorists, supported by the police, attacked freedmen and their white allies in Memphis, Tennessee. 46 new Africans, many of them Union veterans, and two white liberals were killed. More than 7 were wounded. 90 homes, 12 schools, and 4 churches were burned. 5 new African women were raped. In 1872, white Republicans split, with some calling for an end to the enforcement of new African rights in the South. At the so-called Liberal Republic Convention, a number of major white Republicans called for a reevaluation of the Republican Reconstruction policy. Harvey Greeley was nominated for president. In 1893, the Chicago World Fair of World Columbians, Columbia Exposition, a celebration of the 400-year anniversary of Columbus' discovery of the New World, opened in Chicago. The fair featured more than 150 glimpses, also known as the White City. New African leaders pursued different tactics in opposing neglect of new Africans in the Chicago World Fair. Ida B. Wells, Ferdinand L. Barnett, and I. Garland Penn attacked the fair in a pamphlet. The reason why the color of America is not in the World Columbia Exposition. Frederick Douglass supported the pamphlet and held a New African Day at the Haitian Pavilion, where he delivered a blistering attack on the exposition. In 1941,
A. Philip Randolph issued a call for 100,000 new Africans to march to Washington, D.C. to protest discrimination in armed forces
and war industries. In 1948,
Glenn H. Taylor, U.S. Senator from Idaho and Vice President candidate of the Progressive Party, arrested in Birmingham for trying to enter a meeting through a door marked for Negroes.
In 1971, Dr. Theodore K. Lawless, dermatologist and philanthropist, died in Chicago at the age of 78. In 1981, Dr. Clarence A. Baycott, historian and political scientist, died in Atlanta at the age of 75. Hold up. Let's see what else. Let's see. 1988, Reverend Sherman G. Hinks installed the first Black Bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church. In 1990, Marguerite Ross Barnett named president of the University of Houston and became the first new African woman to head a major white university. Also on that date in 1998, Elder Cleaver returned to Essex. Elder Cleaver was the foreign minister of information for the Black Power of Self-Defense and a member of the Black Liberation Army. On May the 2nd, Elijah McCoy, inventor who held over 50 patents, was born in 1844. In 1867. The first Secession of Reconstruction Act passed by Congress divided the former Confederate states
to five military districts under command of Army generals. Elections were ordered for constitutional conventions, and freedmen were enfranchised. Commanders in some states changed the status of blacks by military orders. In March, Major General E.R.S. Canby opened the first jury box to blacks in the South and North Carolina. In April 30, blacks were named policemen in Mobile, Alabama. In 1879, 90 Helen Burgos were educated were born. In 1930, Dr. Mark F. Daly was born. Dr. Mark F. Daly was a co-founder in COBRA. He was a co-founder of the Virginia Republic of Africa, a co-founder of Malcolm X Society, an author, a scholar, overall New African Freedom Fighter. In 1973, on the New Jersey Turnpike, Zahid Malik was murdered. Baba Sunada Kole was captured. Baba Sunada Kole, still is incarcerated to this day as a New African political prisoner. Mama Sunada Kole is a New African political exile. In 1997, Queen Mother Ali Moore returned to Essence. She's a reparationist, former member of Revolution Action Movement, a co-founder of Virginia Republic of Africa, the first signed decade of the New African Declaration of Independence, and overall New African Freedom Fighter. In 1999, Reverend Jackson L. Jackson Sr. won freedom for the three American servicemen held prisoner in the Yugoslavian conflict. In 2013, the FBI put a $2 million bounty on Mama Sasha Kier and called her the most wanted terrorist. In 2016, Mama Afina Shakir returned to Essence. She was a former Black Panther Party member, former political prisoner, former member of the Panther 21, and a continued African citizen. On May the 3rd, 1845, Macon B. Allen, the first black lawyer admitted to the bar, passed examination at Worcester, Massachusetts. Septimus Clark, Sirrah Adams, educated, born 1898. 1948, Supreme Court ruled in Shelby v. Kramer that federal and state court could not enforce restricted covenants that barred persons from owning or occupying property because of their race. In 1968, New African students seized finance building at Northwestern University and demanded New African origin curriculum and campus reform. In 1988, a Philadelphia grand jury cleared Mayor W. Wilson Gould and his top aide of criminal responsibility in 1985 firebomb led to the death of 11 persons and destruction of 60 homes. After a two-year investigation of the city's greater tragedy, the jury criticized the mayor and his aide for the attack, for their action in the attack of the house of the militant black group, the Move family. You know, they're still persecuting our brothers and sisters to this day, even though a lot of them on the street, they still have been attacked. On May the 4th, 1864, Ulysses S. Grant crossed the Rapidan and began his duel with Robert E. Lee. All at the same time, at the same time, Benjamin Butler's army of the Giants moved on Confederate forces. New African Division and Grant's army did not play a prominent role in Wilderness Campaign, but Butler gave his New African infantrymen his 1,800 New African cavalry important assignments. New African troops of the Army of Giants were the first Union soldiers to take possession of the Giants River at Wilson Wharf Landing, Fort Powhatan, and City Point. In 1891, Providence Hospital opened at 12 Knight and Dearborn Streets in Chicago, one of the first training schools for New African nurses. In 1897, Joseph Smith patented the lawn sprinkler. In 1961, 13 freedom riders began a bus trip through the South. On May the 5th, 1905, the first issue of Chicago Defender was published by Robert Abbott. It's a New African publication. In 1950, Gwendolyn Brooks, a poet, won the Pulitzer Prize. In 1971, a riot occurred in Brownville Station, New York City. In 1987, Thomas v. Bowen defeated Mayor Richard G. Hatcher in Gary, Indiana primary. On May the 6th, 1787, African Lodge number 459 overnight in Boston with Prince Hall of the Master. It was less than a month after the founding of the Free African Society
And the two events, one occurred in Philadelphia, the other in Boston, testified to a powerful leap in group consciousness. They later became known as the Prince Hall Masons, a PHA. 1812, Mar R. Delaney, pioneer, black national, born free in Charleston, Virginia. 1922, Gloria Richardson, civil rights activist, was born. In 1960, President Eisenhower signed the Civil Rights Act of 1960. 1967, Aretha Franklin released a Latin album containing the hit single R-E-S-S-P-E-C-T. In 1968, from the 6th through the 8th, 400 students seized the administrative building at Cheney State College. In 1966, Jane Merritt was shot doing solo march against fear. In 1995, Ron Cook elected mayor of Dallas. May 7, 1885, Dr. John E.W. Thompson, graduate of Yale University Medical School, named Minister to Haiti. 1925, Department of Negro Literature and History, now that the Schomburg Center opened at 135th Street branch of the New York Public Library. In 1946, William H. Hashey inaugurated as the first New African governor of the Virgin Islands. In 1961, riots to protest segregation in New Orleans occurred. Now, those are a couple of events happening in history during this week. Of course, there are more, but we're going to push forward. I'd like to commend all the individuals who are currently educating themselves, who are currently organizing their community, and currently being the best version of themselves they can particularly be. I'll thank everybody for listening to our broadcast in 2014. Thank everybody who's been supporting GJU. Obviously, free land, all those identified land, revolutionary ingredients, free all the political prisons, free all the Catholic American citizens. And I'd like to bring on to the show tonight, Brother Dorsey Nunn. Okay, open your line, brother. Okay. Are you there, brother?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well, brother. How about yourself? How you doing tonight, brother?
Oh, man. You know, my gout is flaring up, but I'm still here.
Yes, sir, man. First of all, thank you for coming to our broadcast and sharing knowledge and understanding. Also, thank you for the work you're committing to pad, the present, and the work you're committing to the future. Before we start this off, can you tell the people about yourself, who you are, what you stand for, and what you do?
Oh, you want me to do it?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I'm a little bit shy to do that because, like, most of the time I'd be talking about, you know, what my fight has been. And I've been, I was arrested in 1971 and I got out in 1981. I have had no other job other than fighting for the full restoration of civil and human rights of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people. I'm currently the executive director of Legal Services for Prisons with Children, which is, you know, unusual being that it's a public interest law office. And I don't have a law degree, but I have a lot of experience in the law library. At this point, I got three attorneys working in the organization, and the organization is about 27 people. I'm also a proud member of something called Free at Last, is a community-based recovery center in East Palo Alto. I'm also a proud member of All of Us Anon, a founding member of All of Us Anon, and we have something like 30 chapters scattered across the United States, 12 in California. Some of the fight and the work that I've been engaged in includes Ban the Box, which is removing the question off employment applications that ask the question, have you been convicted of a felony? And in that regard, at this point, we started that campaign in probably 2003. At this point, 267 million people in the United States stay in the jurisdiction where box has been banned in full or in part. We also banned the box in its entirety in the state of California, making that effort, banning the box in the fifth largest economy in the world. The other thing that we have been known to do is that we've been pushing for access to fair housing because we think it's crazy for somebody to go and try to rent a place to live. And the first thing that comes up is a question about your conviction history. In that regards, we have helped establish model programs in Berkeley and in Oakland where that won't be the first question, one of the first questions on the application. And we actually believe if you're going to ask that question after you made a conditional offer for employment or housing, because if you ask that question first, we don't have no way of measuring the structural discrimination in which we're facing. We have also, as legal services for prisoners with children, we've also sued the state of California to improve the healthcare access to women in California prisons, prison in Central California Women Facility. We've also helped pass legislation which outlaw shackling of pregnant women prisoners coming out of state prisons and some and partially in county jails. So that's just a few of the things that I've been engaged in, you know, and I have been recognized, you know, in multiple places through elected officials, probably from the White House now.
Okay. That's a lot of information, man. That's a lot of information. You know, when we were looking at certain things like that, you know, the first thing you said, you know, that you was incarcerated, right? What actually prepared in your mind while you were incarcerated that you're gonna get outside and do this work? Or was that something that you actually thought about when you were incarcerated?
Not initially when I went in. When I went in, I wish I could say that I was politically astute when I went in. You know, I went in for, you know, a common robbery that I was involved in, and a person was killed in the middle of that robbery, and I was sentenced to life in prison, and I think that they arrested me at the age of about 19. But while I was in, you know, I probably took the route of a lot of people who initially go in, you know, barely could read, you know, cowboy books, you know, girly magazines and anything I could get my hand on that was entertaining.
Yeah.
Then I started meeting people who were around that, whether they recognized it or not, impacted my life, you know, and when I first went to prison, you know, the second prison I went to when I was incarcerated, they sent me to a place called Dual Vocational Institution in Tracy, California. And on the yards, they used to have political education courses, you know, and, you know, if you knew how to read and learned how to read real well, what they would do is give you an opportunity to actually find to stand up in a group of brothers and actually start reading, you know. And then, in fact, I can remember, you know, after I really learned how to read the book that I was responsible for reading and actually reporting on was Soul on Ice. But, you know, along the way I read Fanon, I read, you know, Malcolm, autobiography. I read Quanfort, Dialectical Materialism. I read The Solidaire Brother. And I think that I read George's second book when, because by the time he wrote the second book in California, it was outlawed inside the institutions. So I think I read the second book, George's second book. I think it was in written in longhand, because one of the things that brothers had going on the yard is if the book was banned, what they would do is certain brothers would take out a chapter and write it down and pass it around. You know, so you know, I read some of George's work written in longhand on the yard at DVI. I also read stuff like Che Guevara, Mao Zedong, Ho Chi Minh, and a number of other people who were revolutionaries during that period of time. I read about Guinea-Bissau, you know. So, you know, I just kept on reading. Then at a certain point along the way, I sort of figured, like, you know, I don't know if anybody ever did that kind of time, that no matter what they did, you know, they can give you, you can have family visits, you can have all the canteen you want, you're going to let you have individual TVs, individual radios, At one point, nothing they could have gave me other than my freedom would have meant anything to me. You know, then I start trying to figure out, like, you know, how do I get out? At the period of time that I was in, I could see, because a lot of brothers would give me, they would get a something like the San Francisco Chronicle or the New York Times or some other magazine or newspaper, and a lot of them would just pull out the sport page, but they would give me the rest of the paper. And when I'm reading the paper, I could see society politics changing to the degree that I can see them getting more conservative and more conservative. So around about 1978 or thereabout, 1976, I started focusing on what did I need to do to get from out of San Quentin, because they had transferred me to San Quentin when I was about 23. How did I get out of San Quentin and get a parole date and come to the streets? And then I start, you know, stop lifting weights, stop jogging around the track. And what I started doing was going to the law library and start looking at a way to get out and start examining how did I make the best approaches to the board. And there were older brothers at the institution at San Quentin, and they were at DVI, and they started giving me telling me different ways that I should approach my board appearance. In 1981, I got out. I walked 100 yards and got a job at the prison law office, where I immediately started suing San Quentin for the abuse and torture of human beings in cages. And I've been at that kind of work probably for most of my life.
Okay. That's a bit of a thought, man. You know, you transfer your mentality. Revolution, criminal revolution, that's a bit of a thing, like Conrad George said. You know, I see you got a lot of level of expertise, you know, legal and policy advocacy, race and justice, meaning organized leadership development, fundraising, campaign development, mindset, and public speaking, right? You know, to tell us a little bit more about your executive director position at the LSPC, and what exactly is LSPC and what the mission of it for people who don't know.
It's legal services for prisoners with children. That's the acronym is that's the full name, legal services for prisoners with children. And we are a support center for field offices, you know, like the prison law office, legal aid, and what have you. You know, that's some parts of what it does. But when I think about the work that we've been engaged in, and I've been there working for 30 years, you know, some of the work that we engaged in, some of the work I'm the most proudest of doing, included we were I had a chance as an executive director to assign an attorney to work on suing Pelican Bay that helped it end long-term solitary confinement in Pelican Bay, you know. And so that was some of the stuff we did. When it came to policy work, we did policy work that stopped shackling of pregnant women prisoners. When I think about some of the policy work, All of Us Anon is under the umbrella of Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, because we had money as Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. We didn't have no money. We had money as Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, but when we was first starting as All of Us Anon, we didn't have any resources. So one of the things that I did when I was a director was start bringing on formerly incarcerated people onto the staff, because more than 50% of my staff at this point is formerly incarcerated, you know. And I started figuring out, you know, if I was going to have a voice and other people was going to have a voice, we had to actually start not only talking, but raising the number of people who were speaking so people could hear us, you know. And so, like, Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, when we sued something like the California State Prison in Central California Women's Facility, that's who we sued, and we sued for inadequate medical care. But before we even filed a suit, what we did was held a meeting, and because at the point that we actually initiated the suit, I knew the lawyers would stay around as long as there was a constitutional violation. But the women who was actually being subject to being tortured and abused would be in prison longer than that. So what we did was establish the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and they've been in existence for over 25 years at this point. You know, because one of the things that we wanted to do was to ensure that after the lawsuit ran its course, that they would have somebody out there advocating for the restoration of civil and human rights, as well as the protection and the care of women in prison. So legal services started that right there. In the event that when we kept on going, we also sued for inadequate medical care in a number of county jails in the state of California, and we sued that people were going to jail, particularly women, and if they were addicted and pregnant, they didn't necessarily care. So we sued that people in prison who was pregnant have access to methadone in the event that they was incarcerated, because we thought that it was cruel to the baby to actually to be subject to a withdrawal with no help whatsoever. We've also we're getting ready probably when the pandemic hit, legal services and all of us are none, when they start letting people go in at Santa Rita County Jail, what we thought was that while we're in the middle of the pandemic and because they had an outbreak of COVID in the county jail in Alameda County, what was our responsibility if we say we love people that's incarcerated getting out of jail? So what we did was pulled our resources and we went and rented 50 rooms at the Comfort Inn. So when people got out, we was meeting them at the gate and giving them vouchers so they can actually go house themselves, because we thought if they was leaving a facility that was being wrecked by COVID-19, they should think about what their next move was, because there was no need of dragging a deadly disease from where they were to in the middle of the community. So we put them up in a motel for 30 days. We also made sure that when we put them up in a motel, that they could survive and their family can survive. So we gave away $87,000 and $100 vouchers to family members and people that was housed in the motel. So what we was trying to do was that kind of work. When we talk about legal services for prisoners with children, we also write manuals. We also have attorneys that actually engage in suing we have sued both the state, different state prisons in California, as well as county facilities. And I sort of like the idea that I can see the conversation change when I go in and say I'm an activist and I'm all of us are none, how they talk to me. And then when I say I'm the executive director of legal services, how they talk to me. And once I dropped the fact that I had the ability to actually deliver consequences, the conversation changes.
Yes, sir. they get intimidated because you know the law. You're associated with the law, knowing the legal aspects. You know, as a conversation changer. You know, that's a lot of work, man. In regards to what you're doing, what type of relationship do you have with Critical Resistance in regards to a lot of the work you're doing?
I was one of the founders of Critical Resistance. I was there when we initiated the first conference. You know, because like probably I felt that the prisoners' rights movement probably collapsed shortly after the death of Faith Stender. And when I was coming out of prison, one of the things that I wanted to do was how do I actually engage in work that actually strengthened and expanded the number of people that actually was fighting this issue. And one of the places that I worked at, one of the projects I worked on over the course of time was at that first conference at UC Berkeley. And that's before we had an organization called Critical Resistance, because Critical Resistance started out as a conference. And when we did the conference, we was expecting maybe 300 or 400 people. You know, I think probably a couple thousand showed up at that conference. and we start filling that room. I think that we had I think the workshops that we put on over the course of that 2 or 3 day period, probably put on maybe 100 workshops about prison. And the thing that that stood out was that this conference centered itself around how do you initiate campaigns that talk about abolition, you know. And, you know, and I have been going to, you know, over the course of time, once that I got out and got situated, I started going to the International Conference on Penal Abolition, you know. And, I, you know, I had went to, you know, places like New Zealand, Canada, and other countries to actually have conversations and to see how they was addressing the question of penal abolition, you know. And I thought the work that we did with Critical Resistance was critical, because what I think that it accomplished in a real way was to give people the idea that we could dream beyond prison reform and start dreaming about abolition. You know, the other thing that it did was that it brought what I thought was intellectuals back into the game. You know, it brought academics back in, because at the death of Faith Standard, a lot of them disappeared. So I don't think that the prison industrial complex was built with real resistance at a certain point, because a lot of the people that was resistant weren't necessarily struggling the same way that we struggle now. And definitely a lot of the organizations didn't have formerly incarcerated leadership that was actually putting in any real work, you know. And all of those things started to occur in a real particular way. You know, like I can remember going in the room and sitting at tables, and I was the only formerly incarcerated person at the table. You know, that's no longer the case right now. I can walk in the room and look around and call people that I served time with. Now, if I didn't serve time with, there's two generations behind me, because I hadn't been doing this so long that I hadn't got old with something I didn't anticipate doing, you know, was getting old. Thought I'd be long dead before now. But anyway, so that's what the critical resistance was, you know, because, like, you know, like I said, I'm still fighting, homie. So, like, death, the fact that death is going to occur, it's not going to be a surprise. The only surprise will be when.
Okay, true indeed. You know, I understand that you was in the documentary called The 13th. Tell a little bit more about that documentary. You know, what did it mean? What did it actually mean for people to be aware of the 13th Amendment? What did it actually mean?
The 13th Amendment is that they got, they qualified into law the practice of slavery and saying people that were duly convicted of crimes could be enslaved. And that's the 13th Amendment in the United States Constitution. And that was with Ava DuVernay, you know, and I can remember sitting there interviewing, being interviewed by Ava DuVernay for the movie The 13th. You know, most of the time that I spent doing the interview with Ava, because I really liked you know how you get around Africans and black folks, and sometimes you can get real comfortable. And when I get that comfortable, and we having real serious conversations, that sometimes I start crying, you know, because my oppression had been ongoing for most of my life. And and I can remember one of the things that I thought about when I was talking to Ava DuVernay is that as a result of having a felony, that they were killing us, you know, and nobody was, you know, jumping out saying, you know, I think they was hunting some of us down, you know, like I'm saying, like those ones over there, those are the ones that ain't going to take no instruction, you know, they ain't going to be docile, you know. So I actually thought that group of people that they were actually hunting and killing us, then they would excuse our death by saying that we was violent and we had a felony, you know. Then when I'm sitting there, being a videotape, because I had to stop a couple times for that real small segment in 13, because what I thought about when I was there is how many of us that they stripped our right to bear arms as a result of going through the criminal justice system. You know, do we have the ability to actually defend our community? You know, so like half the people I grew up with, if they get caught close to a gun, they're going to have whatever situation that come up, have their sentences in hand, or they you know, in the event that they catch them and they resist, they're going to be shot. That's what I thought about when I was doing the movie 13th. You know, and not only did, you know, I do the movie 13th, if they read the new Jim Crow, I'm in that one too, because I know Michelle Alexander. You know, so it's like, you know, and, you know, like, that's what I'm saying. When you ask me to introduce myself, it's sort of hard without it sounding like I'm bragging and shit. So, you know, so like most of the time, I'm just, you know, and you know, so half the time people ask me, say, like, how I'm doing, you know. Hell, I'm still here. I think I'm doing great, you know, because like I said, I anticipated the outcome would be different by now.
True.
So, like, you know, that, you know. You know, so, but, you know,
yeah, go.
I thought the 13th was a real good documentary, you know. And, you know, and I also thought that the new Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander expanded the conversation in such a way, because I can remember when Michelle sent me you know, like a lot of people get that banned copy or something. I got
yeah.
the banned copy of the new Jim Crow, and she sent it to me, right? So, like, at that time, you know, I'm hanging out, and I'm in Las Vegas on vacation, and I couldn't leave the room because I'm reading Michelle's book. And at that point, I had got resources from something called Drug Policy Alliance. And part of
yeah.
the resources I got was to say, you know, there wasn't a war on drugs. There was a war on people. That's what I was out there saying, because when you looked up, you go around. I ain't never seen a prison full of drugs. I seen a prison full of people. You know, so if it was a war on drugs, they would have had a whole prison full of that stuff. I didn't see a whole prison. I seen a whole bunch of people that I went to, you know, kindergarten with, church with, you know, ran around in the streets with from my community. And then when I got there, I found out that a whole bunch of other people's community had been disrupted like that, you know. But when I read Michelle Alexander's, like I said, I could get out of I ruined my vacation because of going down, getting the food in Vegas, doing some gaming or seeing sightseeing. I wind up staying in the room the whole weekend and reading Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. And the way that it was, you know, a lot of it wasn't new information to me, but the way that she wrote it, I thought was accessible. So probably by the time I finished reading Michelle Alexander, a book, what I did was ultimately called her, you know. And generally when you write a book, what people do when it's beginning to, if it starts to break and you start getting a lot of copies sold, then the next thing that happens is that, you know, you start getting invitations with honorariums from universities and prestigious places. And I thought the book was so significant that me and a person named Susan Burden probably bought out close to the first printing of the book, and we started giving it away. The other thing that we did, at least in terms of what I was responsible for, is I got some money from somebody named Asha Bendeli that used to work at the Drug Policy Alliance. And what I did was start setting up speaking engagements for Michelle in the middle of the black community, because I thought that what we need to do is have access to the information that she was putting out, because her book was real relevant, you know. So it's like it wasn't like they was theoretically conducting a drug war and we just got called in. We could have been the target of that stuff. So that's what I wanted people to read, was how she broke down and how she had wrote about the new Jim Crow in a way. And when it took off, it really, really meant that this conversation about incarceration took it further than probably stuff that Angela had wrote, or stuff that Ruthie Gilmore had wrote, and stuff that Dennis Childs had wrote, because I don't think that Dennis Childs stuff broke yet. And Dennis Childs put out a book called Slaves of the State, which I think is dense and it's worth reading, you know. But I thought that Michelle Alexander's book was written in such a way that the common person could read it and actually get something from it.
True indeed, true indeed. That actually is a good book. And I know you had mentioned Oscar Bandetti. Oscar Bandetti wrote the book, The Prisoner's Wife. Didn't you write that book, The Prisoner's Wife?
Oh yes. And like at the first conference, I'm sitting there with some of my homies, and it's like, you know, in the hall that we was in at UC Berkeley campus, it was packed. You know, and, you know, probably that conference, I opened that conference, and the first thing we did was gave tobacco to Native Americans, and that could be open the conference, because there was a time on this land that they didn't have prisons, and it just happened to come before, you know, pilgrims and everybody else. Native Americans wasn't incarcerating people. So I figured, like, you know, let's have this conversation and show that the prison industrial complex didn't always exist. And when you talk about the prison industrial complex, you're talking about the marriage of profit and punishment, you know.
Yes, sir.
So that's what you're talking about to the most part when you're talking about that, you know. And one of the the person who probably wrote a book, and it was an obscure term, and he took that obscure term because one of the greatest things that that happened, probably that came out of critical resistance, is the notion of prison industrial complex. They introduced that term into public speech, you know, because you wasn't hearing about it in a whole bunch before that conference and before critical resistance went from a conference to an organization, you know. And, you know, and you know, and people around that, when we was meeting with Angela Davis and a whole bunch of other people starting this conference, what we was that a lot of people around there, like Dennis Childs, Slaves of the State, Ruthie Gilmore, The Golden Gulag, in a whole series of books that came after Angela Davis that got engaged there. And when you talk about Asha Bandelli, like I said, I was in that Wheeler Hall, and the hall was packed. And when she read excerpts from a book, The Prisoner's Wife, and she started talking about all the gods that she had prayed to for them to release her old man, all the brothers was looking up and down the thing saying, man, damn, you know, we didn't know we had people out there that loves us that much, you know, because her book, you know, stood out to us that way because she read excerpts from it from the stage when we first initiated critical resistance at that particular conference. I hadn't read her book at that point. And when that hit, I'm sitting in a row with Luis Talamantes, I think David Johnson, Sundiata Tate. And those were some of George Jackson's crime partners, you know. So that's who I was sitting with, homie. You know, Arthur Lee, who had, you know, went to prison and his introduction was for killing the police. That's the kind of aisle it was that I was on, you know. And we were all saying, man, damn. Her book excited all
Black
of us.
Panthers.
I was like, damn, man.
Yeah, the Black Panther.
It was that way, you know. So, you know, so that's when you talk about critical resistance, it just didn't come out of nowhere. When you talk about All of Us or None, we adopted our name while we was in Louisiana at a critical resistance conference. And what we was asking then was for Panthers to actually give us, we had a vote on what we was going to name the organization. You know, and at that point, Wayne Thompson and John, that was operating out of Oklahoma, was at that conference, you know. So it was that way, you know. So, like, you know, because, like, you know, over the course of this lifetime, he said, I'd have been in spaces. And when, right now, I'm just down, you know, probably the night of Marie, chapter 19, because I'm getting ready to release my own book, you know. And if everything go the way I want it to go, it's going to be called Battered, Beaten, But Unbroken and Undeterred, you know. So that's what I'm going to be writing about. It's probably all of that history, you know. because, you know, with a 40-year history, I think I got to dump it before these people dump me, you know.
So, I got you.
So, like, you know, that's what, you know, because, like, in there, you know, I'm going to have a chapter about, you know, critical resistance, banning the Bob, you know, and fighting for voting rights, you know, inside the state of California, because my struggle is being, like, consistent, you know. And the other thing that I probably want to point out, especially if the brothers in these pens are listening to this program, you don't know which one of us is going to get out and actually ground themselves and put in real work. You know, because, you know, all the people that I served time with, a lot of people I served time with, when they got out, the conditions were so wretched that they didn't get a chance to actually shine the way they probably should have shined when they got out. They got distracted, you know, in a real way because they were just trying to survive, you know. And when brothers are coming home, we need to figure out, you know, what the hell to do, because, like, when I got out, I mean, I'm hanging out with Arthur, and I got this from Arthur Lee, you know. You know how people say, man, you're bright, you're intelligent, you're sharp, you're so exceptional? You know, what they could also be saying is all the rest of your friends are still niggas. How about that one, homie? That's what, you know. And when I made that transition, it wasn't looking back at that point. It was looking ahead. It was like, whoa. So, like, you know, I used to take what they were saying as a compliment until I recognized what they were saying about the rest of the people that I love. You know, so, like, you know, and I ask brothers to think about that when they get in there and talk about how articulate you are. Well, obviously, you ain't hung out with none of the rest of us. Because I'm not the only articulate person in the world, you know. And if you think, if that's it's a low bar, you can speak well. Well, you know, hey, I can do more than that. You know, but, you know, but some of these people that I got a chance to hang out with along the way, was exceptional people. So if you ever get a chance to actually hear Michelle Alexander, and she got books that she's out there, look around and see when does she leave the room. Because at certain points, I was on the detail to protect her while she was going around to these places that I was taking her, and the thing that stood out is that often she'd be one of the last people that left the room. And she would talk to everybody. That meant something because they had been around other people who were greater, more famous, did more work. And their thing was, you know, get me out of here as soon as I get finished speaking, or get me out of here at a certain time. That person, I damn near had to pry away from the people. You know, so it's things that like that I noticed. You know, and you know, in that conference that I went to in New Zealand. When I got there, I was waved into the country because, like, you know, I didn't have because, like, some of the things that I got a chance to go through, it was like it wasn't stuff that brothers was teaching us on the yard. You know, because, you know, when I got to New Zealand, they asked me if I had a visa. I thought a visa was a credit card, you know. Then they start talking about, like, you know what I'm saying? Because we didn't kick it like that on the yard. Man, you know, when you get out, man, you need to get you a visa. You know, I'm looking at, you know, all these brothers that got to, you know, Cuba because they took the plane and shit. So visa wasn't like anywhere discussed anywhere around me, and I was around, like, revolutionary. You know, I was, you know, and in fact, you know, the stuff that I left, like my overalls and all the rest of the stuff, when I got out, I left my stuff to Jajaga, Geronimo. You know, so, like, when I first came in, the person who stayed across the tier from me was Jaleel. So that's the period of time that it came to. So there was a lot of brothers that came through and came into the pen because they had revolutionary values, you know. And everybody on the yard, so, you know, it impacted the yard when you was thinking about what you should be reading. So, like, you could have started out with girly magazines, but that wasn't the end of your day. That was just the beginning of your journey. By the end, you're reading Malcolm, you're reading everybody else, you know. You know, you're thinking about, you know, Africa. And when I got to New Zealand and I had that, I had an immigration problem, and the only thing I had was a fax number for the conference that I was going to be attending, which was about prison abolition, you know. And I contacted the conference organizer, and one of the keynote speakers was the former prime minister of the country. So when I got let in, I didn't even know that they had let me in. They let me pass. But about time that I got to the conference, I was seen as some kind of dignitary. So people was inviting me all over the place, you know. And one of the places that they invited me to was Mount Eden Prison, you know. And when I, you know, and, you know, I'm on the gun rail where they didn't have guns, you know. And I got all emotional because, like, what it demonstrated when I was in Mount Eden Prison, that the people in New Zealand had a greater value on human life than the people that they had incarcerated in the United States. So in the event that a ruckus broke out on the yard, what they would do is disrupt the ruckus by using high-powered water hoses. In San Quentin, they were shooting people. DVI, they were shooting people. Folsom, they were shooting people. Attica, they were shooting people. They never thought about disrupting violence with less than lethal means, you know. And I'm sitting there saying, whoa, man, you know, why in the hell did they shoot my homies? And San Quentin is located on a bay. It wasn't a shortage of water. It was a shortage of respect for us and the ability that they didn't necessarily care about our lives. You know, some in New Zealand said that. The other thing that stood out when I went to that conference, I looked down off of that what would have been a gun rail, but it turned out to be something else. It turned out to be a rail for the guards. When I looked down, I looked on the yard. What was on the yard was on one of the yards I looked at, it was a clenched fist that ultimately became what we wear on our hats and on our T-shirts as all of us and us. Then when I got there, it was the Maori people that looked sort of like Native Americans, they considered themselves black. When did they start considering themselves black? They considered themselves black because they thought they were similarly situated, and what inspired them to do that was the 1968 Olympics when John Carlos then pumped their fists in the air. So pretty soon I'm digging into the community in a whole different way. You know, so like I just wasn't at the conference. I start hanging out, you know, and what comes out of New Zealand is something called restorative justice in terms of what people actually practice or actually emulate in the United States within the criminal justice field. But then when I left New Zealand, because when I get to New Zealand made me question everything. You know, I mean, you know, so, you know, what is truthful about our history? Because it was so much that I, you know, I don't know if you ever got to when you know you don't know. You know, or what you figure like you know might be less than what you need to know. And so when I left New Zealand, the first place I broke to was Cuba. You know, and when I went to Cuba, I was looking for asylum. You know. And I found the solid, you know, because I wanted to know, you know, how did the Cubans just crime? And I didn't know a thing about Cuba, not really. You know, if you had asked me at the time that I get to Cuba, I would have thought they all looked like Don Johnson and Miami Vice. It's a lot of black people in Cuba, you know. And when I get to Cuba, I find the solid, and I'm thinking that she's going to be all scarred up. Dragging a ball and chain. The sister looked absolutely beautiful. She looked absolutely healthy, you know, and that's what I seen. And I thought that I asked her, could I do an interview? And I, you know, and at the point, you know, all I got is an ink pen and a piece of paper. And she asked me, where was you know, did I have a crew or a camera or what have you? And I thought that she would do interview and I found that out, and I went and hunted somebody down that had the ability to record a video, and we cut a video of Asada, and I think that was like 20 years ago, and the name of the video was Yesterday Is Not Too Soon, you know. And I interviewed Asada when I was down there, you know. So it's like, you know, so like I didn't have those experiences when I'm in South Africa. I'm in South Africa with Amsterdam, you know. and I'm, you know, going into Paul's More Prison and all the rest of that stuff, because that's the kind, you know, some people can probably go to the university and get fed. What I got fed was I was going from place to place and looking at, you know, what was there, you know, because like people say anything, you know, but, you know, real revolutionaries should actually measure the truth by the practice. You know, so I was going from place to place to place to place and seeing that stuff, you know, in a real way. And Mount Eden Prison in South Africa was that way. When I get to Cuba, I'm thinking that, you know, I'm, you know, just going in, running in there, sneaking in, sneak out, and I wind up making the front pages of the Cuban paper. Because what I started talking about was the fact that how difficult it was for me to get there, and I knew Cubans at that point that was here, and it was some parts of their resistance to, you know, to Cuba was generational, because the people that was, some of the people that was born here had a damn different feeling what it was to be dark in the United States. The other thing that I learned when I was in Cuba is when Fidel and Castro was marching into the town, what made people fearful? It was the brothers who was out there chopping cane in the field. You know, so like my sense of, you know, how do I learn history could be absolutely different than what was being taught to me in school. You know, because at a certain point, I kept going back to, you know, to the streets. When I'm in El Salvador and I go in and visit Mariana Prison, I'm, you know, at a certain point, I'm in the jungles carrying prostheses to revolutionaries. Legs and arms and all the rest of that stuff, but, you know, I wind up meeting Nidia Diaz, a revolutionary in El Salvador, and one of the things that I asked for and that we got was granted to see how they was treating prisoners inside of outside of San Salvador. You know, when I'm with Angela, we go into Paul's More Prison. You know, So I'd have been to a whole bunch of prisons in multiple countries at this point, because I actually think that every place the queen ever touched, she screwed us, you know, and that's, you know, and when I'm in New Zealand, I'm having I'm at a pub having a food with a Maori and an Aborigine, and what we was talking about was our similarities in terms of our social conditioning in where we were. And some parts of that stem from there. And by the way, nobody else asked me for a visa except for the places that are like New Zealand. I wasn't asked for a visa in El Salvador, Cuba, any parts of the Caribbean or Africa, you know, but where the queen still had the most influence, that's when they asked me for the visa.
True indeed. True indeed. You know, if an individual want to get involved with critical resistance, All Is a None, or any other organization that you're a part of, how would it go about doing so? And also,
you know, you can look us up. It's easy to find us. All you have to do was Google us. You know, any of that stuff you can Google, and you can see what we're doing, the work for it, and all the rest of it. And we're doing a chapter building around the United States with All Of Us Not. Now, if you ask me, like, you know, the other thing is that if you come into Oakland, please stop by 4400 Market Street, because we done bought a building and we named it the Freedom and Movement Center. And what we think it is a sanctuary for formerly incarcerated people. Stop through there, because we might even give you some information about where to go. If nothing more, you know. So most of my staff, you know, is sitting in that building. When you look at the prison, California Prison Focus, it's located in my building, you know, because, like, at a certain point, at my age, I figure, like, you know, 5 years ago, I decided we're going to buy a building because, like, you know, I figure, like, if I'm going to make a tribute to the next generation, leave them something, you know.
Yes,
so what I want to leave them is infrastructure. You know, where they won't have to pay rent. So all they have to do is hustle, you know, in a different way. Because, like, you know, when I moved to 5 years ago, when I moved to Oakland from San Francisco, I made the mistake of calculating how much rent that I had paid. And this dude was telling me that we were going to have to move, and I was asking for 3 month rent. And he was talking to me like he didn't know me, you know. Well, over the course of 17 years, I gave him $1,267,000. I figure, like, for that kind of money, you should have actually said, man, you're my best homie. You know what I'm saying? Because he had pimped the hell out of us with the rent. And then when we got there, when we got to where we got to, the down payment that we made on the building in this part, what gave me the nerve to say that we was buying the building, it came as a result of the lawyer's fees that we recouped pursuing Pelican Bay and ending long-term solitary confinement. So I got a bank, and I think I got a whole bunch of money until I went to buy commercial property. You know, I knew I had more money than most of my homies, or at least I had more disposable income than most of my homies.
Yeah.
And as opposed to, like, waging it out and giving it to bits and pieces, what I, you know, elected to do was to actually buy, build the infrastructure, you know. And when we built the infrastructure, the other part that I learned along the way is how we spend our money is equally important. So when you step into the Freedom and Movement Center and you hit the carpet, that carpet was laid by formerly incarcerated women. When you see the walls that we built in the office spaces that we built, that was built by formerly incarcerated guys. And the person that I hired was a formerly incarcerated general contractor. And I embedded from the very beginning that that's who he was going to hire, so that's who he was going to be giving our money to. You know, so some of those things, you know, and by the way, like I said, I keep hitting these spaces where we didn't have I didn't have full access to information, because I decided to buy a building before I need anybody ever told me that most people initiate a capital campaign. I bought the building because I got tired of people just taking our money. You know, that's what it was. And then, you know, and then people kept saying, you got a capital campaign. It was a no. I didn't have a capital campaign, but I ultimately found out how to pay for the building. You know, but in paying for the building, there was this other lesson that I learned along the way. And, you know, I'm hoping that some of this still don't wind up getting edited out the book. A brother lent me $2.4 million. You know, and I'm thinking, man, you know, and I'm thinking like the racks that I got stacked up in the bank with real money. He told me I had real money. And I sort of felt sort of insulted because I had been working, you know, something like 35 years to acquire that kind of money. So I'm thinking it's real. I think it's real loot, and it's not necessarily real loot. And what he did was lent me the money. I buy the building, and then what we did was went down to a bank, and being that I had a building worth $2.4 million, then when I walked into the bank, I had equity. And off of the equity, I could take out a loan, and I could pay him most of his money back. You know, in a large segment of the money that they lent me would be the debt was being held by a bank. And then I thought about it, being that I was raised poor, and other people that was sitting around me in California, like in Atherton, Silicon Valley, Marin County, and all the rest of those places, they come from a wealthier background. And what I thought about, at no point when I was buying the building did anybody ask me if I had been convicted of a felony. That's what you ask poor people. When you're playing with real money, they're not asking you that question. On the real, you know. And the other thing that stood out, they ask renters for, do you got a felony conviction? You know, the other thing that I learned along the way, that rich people don't dress up for it, so you can see them wearing mismatched socks, everything. Because they're not dressing to please people. So because the person who ultimately donated enough money to buy the building, if you would have looked at it, you would have never knew she was rich. You know, because she paid, you know, she says, I'm going to pay this off in 5 years for you. You know, and but the thing that stood out in my mind was, did all the little white kids that I went to school with, that their parents, when they graduated out of college, that they lend them enough money to purchase a piece of property. Then after they purchase the piece of property, that they have the ability to go down and borrow the piece of property, give most of their parents their money back. And if they did that right there, then you can get into the conversation of how do they you can get somewhat start understanding the wealth gap in the country between black folks and white folks. Because like I said, my traditional education is a different came a different way. And all the way when they talked about that wealth gap, it was theoretical until I purchased the building and seen the way they was playing ball.
True indeed. True indeed.
Nobody asked
no.
me about the damn felony.
At this time I want you to leave some kind of contact information if you want to, and also give us your final thought.
Here's some contact information. If people really want to contact us, you know, you can go to www.prisonersforchildren.org and you look on my web. You can look at our website. If you want to contact me through email, you can contact me at Dorsey@prisonerswithchildren.org, you know. And if there's some final thoughts, my final thought is what I'm working on right now. I'm working on building a senior center for elders coming home from prison, because like if they did help people 30 and 40 years, they don't have any work life coming, you know. They don't have no more work life in them. So what are we going to do as a community to embrace our elders who come home from prison? And that's what I'm going to probably work on for the next 2 years. And at that point, I'm going to stop working because I'll be 72, 73 years old. You know, so the last thing I want to leave behind is because some of my homies that I was in prison with in 1971, 72, and 73 are just getting out of prison. And I know all the stuff that we dreamed about as young bucks, none of that stuff is applicable to their life right now. So if they're thinking about they're going to smoke up all the weed they can find on the beach with women at 77, 78, and 79, that's not what's happening. So, but somebody still got to stand up and make sure that when they come home that they're not sleeping under the bridge or meeting homelessness, because a lot of those people that have been served those multiple decades, when they get out, their parents then died, their girlfriends and boyfriends then ran off, and all the rest of that stuff. How do we incorporate these people back into our communities where they feel welcome? And the closing thought I got to say, if you come to Oakland, look for the Freedom and Movement Center and stop by and visit us, because you would be welcome in our building, particularly if you actually had that same incarceration experience.
Okay. Okay. Again, I want to thank you for coming to our broadcast. Say you not understand, you know, so I was saluting your efforts, man. Thanks for the work that you continue to do. If any, we got any loved ones, comrades, behind any line, please check out some endorsing our work in an organization like Critical Resistance, All Is None, also Lincoln Georgia University, and other ask for like the Amendment 13, and check out the documentary 13, get more information about these situations. I also read Alexander book, the new Jim Crow. And liberate all the new African citizens, along with the resistance.
All right. Hey, thanks, bro, for allowing me to be on. And everybody, June 19th is on a Sunday. The question is, what do we do about slavery now in our lifetime? Because we shouldn't keep looking back at and wondering about, you know, everybody else, what they did. Is what do we do about it right now? All right. See you later, bro. Have a good evening.
Peace.
All right.
You too, bro.
Peace.
Peace, bro. Yes, sir.